I'm here with Tony Walton in the rehearsal space of the Oslo. And he has just finished directing The Devil's Disciple. We're both suffering from allergies. I know that you've been interviewed over and over and over in your life. I do this interview series called Anatomy of an Artist. Uh-huh. Its intention is to help the people who listen hear what it's like to really be yourself. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, artists, at least in that area of their life, are people who are screamingly themselves.
And generally passionate about
and
what they do.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. I'm thrilled that you're interviewing me about directing this production, because most interviews that I've done over the years have been more to do with the design of the set and costumes, which uh-huh. has been my line of work for forever. Although I did start out hoping to become a director, I started out as an actor.
Well, you know, one of the things I'd like to ask you, I know we have short time and I want to do everything, but I want to know how you found this or how it found you.
Well, it was,
do you know what I mean?
It was a sort of mistake.
Uh-huh.
Well, two things happened simultaneously.
Well, wait a minute. I just want to make sure you understand what I mean. I don't mean this production.
No.
Your life.
How I got into it.
Yeah.
In school and college, I'd been a very cocky actor, director. And I joined my brother-in-law-to-be's theater company called Wimbledon Repertory Theater, right near the beautiful old Edwardian theater, which did rotating repertory. Mm-hmm. And it's right by the tennis courts, of course. Mm-hmm. And I joined it as an actor, feeling very confident that this was going to be a good way for me to get to end up as a director. However, with my very first performance in a fairly decent speaking role in front of a real grown-up paying audience, I became so incredibly self-conscious that I realized right away that I wasn't really cut out for this. So
wow.
I didn't want to give up my 3 guineas, so I was about $10 a week, and so I said, is there anything else I can do? So they said, well, we're always in need of stagehands. So for a bit I did that, and then gradually was slid across to help the scenic designer, and then he encouraged me to work with him and then design a couple of my own shows. But simultaneously with this, I have to backtrack a little bit. While still in college, I had been sent to an art school in Oxford, bizarrely called the City of Oxford School of Technology, Art, and Commerce.
We'll cover all the bases.
Ruskinian art school. And but while I was there, the college would just presume that's why I wasn't with them, and vice versa. So I was able to organize for myself a fair amount of
free time.
And I got very involved in marionette productions, starting out with Gilbert and Sullivan and then going on to Mozart, his first teenage opera, Bastienne, mm-hmm. and then The Magic Flute, which doing with string marionettes is kind of an amazing thing, because you can do all the magic, and amazing lighting on that scale and special effects.
So is it that you just found that you had this natural ability?
I just sort of liked doing it. I'd always made little figurines of politicians and stuff like that.
Really? take me back, Tony, really to the beginning, how you discovered acting or making little models or...
I think despite the fact that when my sisters and my brother and I were young, we had no idea that there was any theater connection of any sort in our family until we were in our late teens, at which time my father said, the big old oil painting in the dining room is actually of the mother of C.B. Cochrane. Now, C.B. Cochrane was the English Ziegfeld, mm. and in fact used to feed Ziegfeld some of his acts, like Jumbo and Anna Held and so on. And he had produced all of Noel Coward's first great hits.
My God.
And because my dad was his nephew, he, although he was by then in his late 20s, still studying in medical school, he was invited to go to the final dress rehearsal, invited dress rehearsal, of Noel Coward's wildly successful musical hit, Bittersweet, mm-hmm. from which comes I'll See You Again and so on. And The Love We're All and all those beautiful songs. And my dad invited a gal, a young girl that he'd had an eye on for a while, who was 11 years younger than him, she was about 16, to this invited dress, and in fact proposed to her in the course of the production.
My God.
And they did ultimately get married. She was 17 by the time she actually agreed, and they did get married. And for years, we never, my brothers, brother and sisters and I never really quite understood why, if one of those songs, such as I'll See You Again, played, the two of them, our parents, would dissolve. They would immediately be holding hands, and my dad would force a fist into his mouth to stop himself from crying, you know. So we knew there was something there. At any rate, he finally, I was by then wooing and had been a teenage boyfriend of a young theatrical trollop called Julie Andrews. And so as soon as my mum and dad realized that I was getting involved in this naughty world, they decided to let us know that we had this. Very interesting. It later turned out that my mother is a member of the John Drew family, the Barrymore family.
Oh, my,
which
yes.
Is extraordinary. But we didn't discover that till about 10 years ago.
So we have Julie Andrews really to thank for this.
Yes,
to thank for
in
this.
A way, yes, yes. And ultimately, of course, for my coming to America, because she was over here in The Boyfriend. And
yes.
While I was doing my 2 years of compulsory military service in the 50s, my early 50s, I was an inept pilot. But I used to take every opportunity I could to shoot down to New York from Canada, where I was training. And it was 53, 54, the height of
yes.
the Tennessee yes. Williams, Arthur Miller, Rodgers and Hammerstein, then and
yeah.
An amazing time, and particularly in design. At that time, in England, Europe, and even America, most design was like attractive illustrated backgrounds to the action. But at this time, it was changing and becoming an enveloping.
Yeah, integral.
Sometimes integral, yeah, and sometimes poetic. Mm-hmm. Like Joe Melzine, the great mm-hmm. sort of star of American scenic design, was using scrims and all kinds of interesting materials and doing his own writing.
Well, it was all maturing, wasn't it?
Yes, very much so. And I was aghast at it. Anyway, again, to backtrack for a moment, during the production of my Marionette Magic Flute, a very fine, fine artist in England, John Piper, whose work is all in the Tate Gallery and so on, and is actually kind of well known in America too, happened to be there in the audience, looking like a medieval saint in a stained glass window, and pencil thin, and white, white hair, and gaunt, and very tall. And he came backstage at the end of the performance, and it was a startling, thrilling sight, because we all knew who he was. And it was almost like as if George Bernard Shaw had walked in and been that extreme and a thing. And he said, "Which one is Walton?" Because there were a lot of us singing and performing. I was also singing the part of Papageno, as well as operating and designing and all that. So I put up my finger, and he said, "You should do this." And I said, "What is this?" Excuse me. And he said, "Stage design." He said, "I'm a visiting professor at the Slade School of Fine Art in London, and I'd like you to go there."
Oh my God, this is Deus Ex Machina, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I went there during the same period of time that I was working
when one of them thought you were there, and one of them thought you were.
Mornings I was at the Slade in London, and the rest of the day I was down at Wimbledon Repertory Theatre.
Mm-hmm.
And at the Slade, it was a totally idealistic, fabulous, very, very famous and fabulous art school. The Royal College of Art is the sort of formal, traditional mm-hmm. College of Art, and all the famous naughty artists came from the Slade School, which
yes.
is the sort of renegade.
The Edge,
yes,
right? Yeah. They're you.
But they didn't want to teach you any nuts and bolts. They just wanted to try and give you a little key to your visual soul,
I'm suddenly, I'm thinking about, you know, the Music Man. You just have to think it, and you'll,
yes, yeah.
you'll be able to do it.
Yes.
Right?
It was very weirdly destructive to a lot of students who had come from other stage design schools and had reached a certain level. And the teaching at the stage sort of broke that down, because much of their work, if they were all set the same project, was sometimes quite hard to tell apart because they'd been taught the same things, you know. And what the Sade was trying to teach us was, what is it, what is your response?
It's what I was talking about before, who are you?
Yes, exactly.
You know, not everybody...
No, well, it's a hard thing to get to.
Yes.
And at that age, I was a bit impatient with it because I wanted to know how to do a ground plan and all the nuts and bolts and technical stuff. But I was getting that willy-nilly at Wimbledon. And, you know, we were banging the same old bits of scenery into new shapes and slopping a different color on it. It was the exact opposite of this other idealistic experience. And sort of weird to go through at the time. But I do believe it was the luckiest thing that ever happened.
I'm sure it's true. You had to integrate.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
You had the both sides to integrate, and you were able.
Yeah.
To
well,
take it and run with it.
That's really dumb luck. But I mean, just kept quarreling with myself and trying to figure out how to incorporate the two things into each other.
It probably wasn't
out to
dumb
be very
luck.
Valuable. It may have been.
No. No, and so Modest and Shy too. Huh? Well, okay, so that's how you got launched into scenic design. Clearly, I mean, the universe was saying, essentially, here, go do this, right?
Yes,
you know, right?
I had started out to be, like my dad, a surgeon, but I had, in all of the crucial exams while still in school and college, the medically related subjects were the things I did least well in. So we kind of got a message. Plus, I used to have a tendency to topple over if I saw somebody's finger bleed. I would have probably not had a very good bedside manner. At any rate,
you crawl in next to them, right?
Yeah. But as a result of that, the fact that I clearly wasn't shining at my specialist subjects, the teachers in my college moved me into a classics remove where we were studying, you know, Latin and Greek, and used to have to come up with acres of memorized Ovid and Horace and so on. And it, I have to say, it was tedious, although very useful for crosswords.
Well, and also for someone who thought they were going to be an actor.
Well, that's true, too, yes.
You know, I mean, it's wonderful training.
It is true, it is, yeah. But I was impatient with it, and one day I had the extremely poor taste to have, instead of memorizing my Ovid, I memorized a Stanley Holloway monologue. He was Doolittle, you know.
I do, absolutely.
And he used to do these wonderful North Country monologues.
Yes.
And this one was called Albert and the Lion. And the nature of it was, there's a famous seaside place called Blackpool, which is noted for fresh air and fun. And Mr. and Mrs. Rumsbottom went there every year with their son. He was a fine little lad, was young Albert, and so on. And then it says, the weather was quite disappointing. The waves, there was piddling and small. There was no wrecks, and nobody drowned it. Fuck, nothing to laugh at all. And this, of course, went down quite well with my fellow pupils and not at all with my teacher. So he was the one who booted me off into the art school in Oxford to get me out of his hair.
Oh, how funny. But again,
just a piece of dumb luck.
Well.
It was.
Yes, no, I believe you. I believe
you. But the reason he sent me to art school was that I had started doing posters for the Drama Society.
So he could explain to himself why he would do
this.
I mean, it would make sense for you.
He saw I had a visual streak, which I wasn't even that aware of at the time. It was just stuff I did.
You know? It does sound like you were not, that it took you a long time to be aware.
Well, I was focused into being a surgeon, because my dad was a spectacular and ultimately quite famous surgeon. He was chosen by Sister Kenny to be her kind of legal face in the treatment of polio, because she was
a nurse, so she had no
official credentials, and she needed a partner who had that. And oddly, my dad was visiting America for some reason, and she happened to come across him in New Orleans at one of those
more dumb luck
medical conventions. And so he set up a lot of the polio clinics in the 50s and late 40s that really sort of changed what had started to happen with the polio plagues. You know.
I remember that too.
And he had treatment rooms in our home, and so you would see these little kids, little tortured kids, and you'd see what he was able to do with them, and also see the devastation that came over him if one of them died, and it was very moving.
An unusual man, your father.
Oh, totally, and I very much wanted to emulate him. So I guess that's why all these fripperies that I was mucking about with weren't things that I took very seriously at the time.
Well, okay, so there was the desire to direct through all of this?
Yes.
Right?
Well, it sort of got blown away a bit. I did direct soon after I came to America to stay in 1956, and I was in New York with Julie, and My Fair Lady was then on, and she was working round the clock, and plus, if you're in a hit of those proportions, there are all these other things you have to do all the time.
Yeah.
So I had quite a bit of time to myself, and I went to two drama schools. One of them was the Actors Studio, where I was an observer for about 5 or 6 years. Fascinating. During the time of, you know, Paul Newman and Ben Gazzara and Marilyn Monroe. And I also went to another one, which was at the Circle in the Square, and it was teaching Shakespeare for American theatre folk. And it was a class given by a director who I slightly knew from London. And he'd actually been a visitor at the Slade School. And so in that class were a lot of sort of what one thinks of as a traditional actors, but also the entire cast of the first sort of seriously druggy play, which was called The Connection by Jack Gelber. And it was famous for having actors who were sort of like the Pacino, Dustin Hoffman kind of actors in it, although they were not. Actually, the wonderful actor who was the president in West Wing.
Oh, Martin Sheen.
Martin Sheen, he was in it. He was in the cast. He actually was sitting in the audience, pretending to be a member of the audience and interrupting from time to time. At any rate, because I was the resident Brit in that class...
You were the real thing.
they asked if I would direct them, this cast of Connection, in As You Like It.
Oh, my God.
And so that was my first American directing assignment. It may have been the strangest Shakespeare production ever put on. But I loved it, and they were really extraordinary. It could not have been less conventional. But it was a great dream, and I always wanted to rediscover
that
taste.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then many, 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 many years and zillions of shows and movies went by, and in, I guess it was in the 90s, the very naughty, very infamous New York critic John Simon interviewed me for New York Magazine for his year-end piece, where he selects someone to do a number on. I actually said to the people from New York Magazine that I'd really rather not, because I didn't think it was a good idea for people in the creative end of the business to mingle with their critics. And they said, well, we'll have a word with him and with the editors and get back to you. So they got back the next day and said, we're going to have to put it this way. You're fucked if you do, you're doubly fucked if you don't. So I thought, well, I've got some pretty strange producers in my apartment, why not go this far? So he came, and at the very end of his interview, to my astonishment, he said, were someone to offer you a play to direct, what do you wish it would be? And if I'd thought for a split second, I would have said a new play by John Guare or whoever, you know. But I didn't think. I just jumped in feet first, because I had always so loved Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, and had actually illustrated it for the Limited Editions Book Club. They put out a double volume of Wilde that you could open from
either end. Just like him.
Yeah. Yes. And one end was Lady Windermere's Fan, and the other end was Importance of Being Earnest. So I had illustrated, and to do that, you pretty much...
You have to know it.
You have to do the costumes, you know, to draw them, and sort of the scenic environment. So I said that, and I thought, what an idiot. You couldn't jump in a deep end than that. You know? But then I forgot about it. And within about a year, I was working on I think it was the revival of Steve Sondheim's Company at the Roundabout. And in the middle of Tex, I got this phone call, and I was very impatient and testy to get back to work. And it was Charlotte Moore, the artistic director of the Irish Rep, and she said, "Is this Tony Walton?" I said, "Yes." She said, "I am calling your bluff."
Oh, that's wonderful.
She said, "And I have a theatre which is a magical space and has the very best toilets on or off Broadway. And I'm inviting you to come and see it." So I did, and I did, and you know, that was how it all got started. And I had an astounding cast with Nancy Marchand.
Oh, my.
Oh, she was almost reason enough on her own. To be Lady Bracknell.
It's my favorite play.
Oh, it's so...
Oh, my
wonderful.
God.
And Eric Stoltz, there could not be a more perfect algae than Eric Stoltz.
Oh, my God.
Melissa Errico was just beginning. And it was just an extraordinarily life-enforcing experience.
Yet again, dumb luck.
Yes. Yeah. And then, of course, because it went well, they asked me to do Major Barbara, and so I started on Shore, and then I managed to persuade them that Coward was one-third Irish. He's actually one-quarter Irish and one-quarter English and half Scots.
Oh.
But I thought that was enough.
It's enough, yes. Yeah. So what did you do?
For a while, they were very resistant to Coward, and then one of their productions, I can't remember what it was, collapsed, and they had to find a replacement fast. So they found a show called Oh Coward in Seattle.
Yes, I know about it.
And I said, "So... You wouldn't let me do one with you doing this?" And they said, "Well, it's called Oh Coward. It sounds Irish." Oh, so I did do Coward's final musical there, which has never been performed in America. And it's based, oddly enough, on Lady Windermere's Fan. So it's this fantastic combination of Wilde.
Well, maybe you can talk them into doing it here.
I'd love to, yes. I'm starting to have those conversations.
That would be great. Yeah. Oh, my God.
We did a little... A very nice little recording of it. And luckily, the Lincoln Center did their theater on film recordings of both those productions. And The Devil's Disciple, too, blessedly. So I'm very happy to have
So is that it now? I mean, are you finally being able to settle into this definition?
Well, I'm trying to, although it's very hard to get people to think of me as a director because I've got this sort of other evident identity. And also, because I'm frequently working in very tight budget situations, and if you do the last show of the season here, it's everybody else has used all the budget. Particularly Michael.
who has the right to it, right?
Yes, of course, absolutely. But so it's, in a way, it works fine for me to design it as well as direct it, because I can duck and weave in ways that might not be possible.
It's just a question of the hats,
yes,
right?
Yeah. But sometimes it's fascinating. Sometimes I get really excited about it. I mean, on the importance of being earnest, I did a little backdrop for the final scene with the lake in front of it, you know, the pavilions out there on the grounds, and I was really excited by it. And then and we were just about to get it painted full scale, when I arrived at rehearsal of that scene, and as I was watching my incredible
the
cast
director.
In rehearsal, I thought, that drop is going to be much too interesting.
The director talking to the...
Yes.
Right, oh my God.
Yes. So I had to switch hats and get rid of it.
But yet again, it's that capacity to integrate, you know, the different parts and come up. I'm so sorry. I don't want to tell you that I think you're wrong, but I don't think that's dumb luck.
Oh.
I think that's something
else. Well,
there's
a lot of it, too.
Well, I believe... All right, you can
have... It's such a naughty business, the one we're in. And, so you have to get lucky, too.
Yes, but...
And I sort of know I am, because I can tell when people resent it.
that you got it and they didn't? The luck
thing?
Yeah,
that I seem to have a kind of charmed and enjoyable life, and which I do.
Yes,
I can't apologize for it. I really love it.
No, I wish you would say that really loud and clear, because I think, you know, as I said at the beginning, the whole show is about helping people become who they are.
Yes.
And one of the reasons that people don't become who they are is because there is jealousy.
Is that, but also you were strongly warned against it, any kind of life in the theatre, for very good reasons. It's a completely daft line of work to be in. So if you don't love it, you should get out. And if you don't,
this is what everybody says.
Yes, yeah.
You can't do it for the money, and
no,
you can't do it for the glory.
Not,
you
no.
have to do it because you can't do anything else.
Exactly right. Yes.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And if you're lucky enough to be, to some degree, able to pick and choose what you do, there couldn't be a better life to be in, especially with the family that you have along with that is as special and rewarding as the work side. And I'm lucky enough to have that too, so you can imagine how that pisses people off.
No, I'm sure that it does. I'm sure that it does.
And I remember seeing that. I worked a lot with Mike Nichols. And when he got married to Diane Sawyer, suddenly, having been the golden boy of Broadway,
yes,
nobody had a good thing to say about him.
Yeah. He became the goat.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, it's ironic and
it was fascinating too, that, because I was still regularly working with him. And mm-hmm. he was doing work every bit as extraordinary and
did
sometimes
he know?
More so. Oh, he was very clear about it, yeah. And that's when he started doing much more film work, because it's just all so much muddier.
Yeah.
But in the tiny world of the family of the theatre, there's no escape. You're dealt with the way you're going to be dealt with.
Well, you know, I think you make an important point about the family,
mm-hmm.
that if you have that to go to,
yes, yes.
you know that it's grounding.
Oh, it's so invaluable. Yeah. The folks who've been assisting me, particularly the gals over the years, are all married and with children and still working on mm-hmm. their own designs. And you know, even as recently as 15 or 20 years ago, that would have been inconceivable.
Yes.
All the people in the sort of creative end of the theatre were solitary folk, or you know, just not able to maintain a family life. Fantastic.
So what do you think has changed?
Well, I think exceptional folk set the example, and suddenly people could see, oh,
I can do that.
Do it. Yes.
right.
Yeah.
Well, and again, you know, I want to go back to this idea of you setting an example of someone who has had dumb luck, who revels in it.
Heather? Do you know Heather Kelly, who's our leading lady in The Devil's Son? Just come and say
hello.
Just come and say hello.
Hello.
This is a very remarkable girl. Still, if you get a chance to see The Devil's
Son. I'm going to see it tomorrow.
Oh, great. Well, then you will not believe that she is still, so to say, a student. She's a totally magical creature and solid pro.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Here, please finish up.
And so we were lucky enough to be visited by Heather.
Heather Kelly.
Heather
who has a perfect name for the Irish Reps.
Yes. yes.
And even Dan O'Donoghue, who plays
yes.
The Devil's Disciple,
yes.
is a perfect name. So I'm hoping I can get them.
Get them all over.
Dan, fascinatingly, D.D., Devil's Disciple, D.D., Dick
Dan.
Dudgeon.
Oh, yes.
Three D.D.'s in
oh,
a row.
Oh, yes. Meant to be.
Fascinating, yes, absolutely. He was born for it. Oh, he's extraordinary, really extraordinary. And as you know, in the other productions, he pretty much has to be doer and introspective, and you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And in this, he's the ultimate extrovert and,
yeah,
and Mr. Mischief, you know. And so,
not unlike
just
you.
Just wonderful. And that's the joy of working on shore, and why I was really tickled to hear the supporter of the theatre saying she'd always been bored by shore. I think people quite often.
Who said that?
Well, this was the lady, one of the people who were involved in the good works of the theatre, who was at my very first little sort of speech when I arrived here in the end of January. And she said, you know, I've seen 4 Bernard Shaw plays here at the Oslo. I was bored by all of them. So I said, well, I'm so glad you're going to come and see this one, because if I have any luck at all, we'll be able to put the mischief in, and you'll see what it's supposed to be like, much as happens with all the time, unfortunately, with Chekhov. You know. Mm-hmm. He writes his title, then he writes a comedy.
And then you miss it. And yes, then people, so many yeah. people miss it.
When we did Mike Nichols' all-star production of Uncle Vanya with George C. Scott and Julie Christie and Lillian Gish and Kathleen Nesbitt and Nicole Williamson, I mean, just this Barnard Hughes,
yes.
amazing cast. Neil Simon was in the first night's audience, and I was in the corridor backstage when he came belting back and hammered on George Scott's door and pushed his way in. And I actually didn't go in, but I could hear him shouting, "I knew it! I knew it! I wish that fucker Stanislavski was still alive." And I said, "See? See?
It's
that's what he called
right
it a comedy."
Right.
And it's totally true of Shaw. He was Mr. Mischief. He was Mr. Crontery. It was, you know, his style, as he himself described it, was cartwheel and drums. and it's that even though it's a solemn and seriously intentioned piece in mm-hmm. many ways, there is so much fun in it and so many great laughs.
And that's what makes it great, don't you
yes,
think?
Absolutely.
That it's again, that's an integration
yes,
of
yeah.
of the, you know, and that's what human, that's what life is,
yes,
right?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And if you leave out one of those
right.
things.
And I've been incredibly blessed to have this troupe.
You've been blessed, period. Saying,
well, I have, but I mean, the fascinating thing was I was nervous because I've never directed a repertory company before mm-hmm. in which you sort of get who you're given to play
right,
the roles.
Right,
and
right.
I've always been able to choose every cast member before. And it was fascinating on arriving to discover that most of the cast were immaculately cast. And there were a couple of people, including the fabulous Heather, who were not obvious casting for the roles. But because they weren't, they've had to find other things that I've had to find
yes.
other things to make it work, and so it really made me focus. And they brought colors that I didn't even know were there in the play, so it's been exhilarating.
It's wonderful. It's yeah. wonderful, and I'm not taking another minute of your time, as all of your actors seem to be here.
Ah,
Tony, thank you so
thank
so
you
much.
Thank you so much. I hope your eyes
and yours too.
Thank you.
Generosity and kindness and sweetness. You can hear it all over him. He's just a dear man who happens to be a genius and wants to attribute all of his success to dumb luck, which is quite endearing, if not possibly the truth, I think. Anyway, as you heard him talk about Dan Donahue, I hope that you are looking forward to that interview. Dan Donahue is a remarkable actor. I saw him in three plays, Inventing Van Gogh in a matinee, and then the following day in a matinee of The Devil's Disciple, and that evening, Shakespeare's Winter's Tale. These are three starring roles, all of them very different, a couple of them vastly different, Van Gogh, tortured soul, Leontes in Shakespeare's Winter's Tale, tortured in a different way, and Dick Dudgeon, the soul of mischief and surprising honor. And you believe Dan Donahue every minute of every single one of these plays. So I'm really looking forward to that interview. Okay, you know, as always, I hope that you got something that you can use from this show, something that is interesting or compelling or amusing or annoying. going to be describing something that I call the great trait swap. The roles that we're playing in our life are actually simply traits that we've decided are acceptable or tolerable or safe, but they're not the only ones that we have access to. And it is possible to swap them with other family members. In a minute, I'm going to talk about that. And then hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. I'm going to be describing something that I call the great trait swap. I'm interviewing the most amazing Tony Walton. You know, when you read his credits, I mean, I can't even do it, it's two pages, and you would know every single movie and play that I am going to name, not only the ones for which he's won the Tony, but just, there's virtually nothing that was on Broadway or major film that Tony didn't have a hand in since something like 1966 or something. But he is generous and humble and dear. And I suppose it's always true with the truly great that they also are the truly kind. The great trait swap. When a family member gives up a role that they have always played, they leave a void. Since family balance requires that all these roles continue to be played, someone else has to pick up the abandoned role. If, for example, little sister is no longer willing to be the family scapegoat, those whose role it had been to tease or blame her will now have no one to harass. Pressure will then be put on the remaining family members to fill that void. Someone else has got to become the family scapegoat. As long as you're convinced that people are just the way they are, you may find it hard to believe that family roles are interchangeable. But nevertheless, it is true. If you change the role you've been playing in the family, other people in the family will feel pressured to change as well. Let's say you've always been the quiet one, and then suddenly you become talkative. Well then, the stillness, the role of the listener that you abandoned, it's going to hang there, waiting to be claimed by someone else. The role of the listener has got to be played by someone. When you start talking, somebody else has to listen. And those people who have always seen themselves as the talkers are likely to feel really anxious when their role is threatened. And however much you want to make this change, when you actually start talking, you're likely to feel anxious as losing your identity as the quiet one, the one who could always get lost in the crowd. Even if you have the capacity to be a very different person, the pressure to continue being who you've always been and allow other people to maintain their comfortable roles is plenty enough to keep you in your place. Even if you're all perpetrating some fiction, the fiction that you couldn't be different, it's a fiction with a really important purpose and one that is not easily ignored, exposed, or overturned. This trait exchange, it can't take place unless one individual in the family really changes his or her role. Acting as if, or pretending to be someone you're not, that won't work. You must actually cast off the trait or role. But as soon as you do, there's this magical quality about the way the role you've abandoned is transferred to another family member. In an effort to maintain the family balance, families assign qualities to individual family members that are not complete. Instead of assigning both sloppiness and neatness, allowing someone to be all of the things that it is possible to be, all of the qualities that are in the system, they assign one or the other. So you're likely to have in the system, in the family, one sloppy person and one neat person. One caretaking, dependable person and one selfish or irresponsible or screw-up person. Now, all of those qualities are actually in the system, neatness and the capacity to be sloppy, and responsibility and irresponsibility. They are all in the system, and I believe that if the quality shows up in the system anywhere, it shows up in everybody. But we are encouraged to expose one and hide the other. Something that I think is difficult to get a hold of is the idea that neither neatness nor sloppiness, nor dependability nor irresponsibility are actually all good or all bad. There are times in the life when it's useful to be neat, but there are also times in the life when it's useful not to be concerned about neat. Not to be worried about whether this or that is sloppy. Maybe you understand what I'm talking about. Certainly, there are times, maybe most of the time, when it's good to be responsible, but there are essential times when it is necessary to abdicate responsibility, to allow yourself to be taken care of. Not to focus so strongly on responsibility, sometimes to the detriment of those people for whom you feel responsible. So you can see that qualities in and of themselves are not either good nor bad. But once we've been assigned the quality, if we've been told by our family that we're the neat one, then we're holding on to that for dear life, even if the quality is something that we think of as negative. Let's say you're the person who was assigned sloppiness in your family, and so you just can't seem to make your bed, you can't seem to get everything into the drawers, you can't seem to put anything back, whatever it is. You may not like that about yourself, and you may be scapegoated in the family about that, but that is the quality that you've been assigned. And as I've been saying over and over with the great trait swap, if you were to give that quality up, if you were to find your capacity to be neat, then someone else in the family would have to start expressing their ability to be sloppy. And I don't have to tell you, the neat people, the people who have come to think of themselves as neat and are proud of it, are not going to embrace their capacity to be sloppy, even though it would be in their best interests. And that's, of course, the point I'm trying to make here. In order to be who you really are, you have to be able to be all of the things that come with the territory of being you. And all the things in your family pie, all of the qualities which you have assigned to anybody, they are part of you too. This becomes especially important when the change you want to make in the life or the thing you want to do with your life requires that you access a quality that has been assigned to somebody else. So let's say you have a really big job that you have to produce, work on, but you are obsessed with making the bed and putting the dishes away and getting the things in the dishwasher in exactly the right way that they go in and the places where the knives go and the forks go. And then you have to pick up after everybody else because, God knows, other people in your family got assigned sloppy. And you are unable to give up neatness, even to take care of something that's really much more important than whether the dishes get in the dishwasher correctly. Your ability to accept sloppy at that time would be essential to you. But if you don't realize that sloppy is just as good as neat when it's needed, and if you haven't been able to consider unbalancing the family, you won't have access to that quality, and you will not be able to be who you really are. So, if you've done your family pie, or are doing your family pie, or are considering doing your family pie, look at all of the qualities that you have assigned to anybody in that pie, in that system. Mother, father, sister, brother. And if you want to expand it, you can bring in grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins. You'll see there'll be repeats over and over again, and you'll see how the balance is maintained. But most important, you will see what you were assigned and what you were not assigned. And if you see qualities in there that you think you could use, then consider the possibility that they're already in you. Don't try and change. Just try and think about what the system would do if you suddenly took on a quality for which you were not known in your system.